and see the calendar date and all that stuff on the Independent Police Review website.
And before we leave for the week, we just want to say, if you have any questions or comments or tips or the inclination to get involved with this show at all, this is definitely a half hour devoted to policing and the community response to policing. So if you are interested, please do get involved. You can email us at totalityradio@gmail.com. That's totalityradio, all one word, @gmail.com. Tell us what you think, and we will grit our teeth and read it.
So. Yeah, cool.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm Sam Bowman.
I'm Jasmine. And thanks, Liam.
Thank you to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs on Sunday, April 14th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Mission Theater in Portland. PDX Short Docs is a two-hour program of Portland-related short documentaries created by local filmmakers. This year, there will be several virtual reality short documentaries included in the 6 to 7 p.m. part of the screening. There will also be a Q&A with many of the filmmakers. Again, that's PDX Short Docs on Sunday, April 14th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Dr. Meltzer made a comment here just a Dr. Meltzer.
Give me a head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, streaming, flaxen, waxing. Give me down to there, shoulder length longer. Here, baby, there, mama, everywhere now. In my hair, a home for the fleas, a hive for the buzzing bees, a nest for birds. There ain't no words for the beauty, the splendor, the wonder of my hair. Grow it, show it, long as I can grow it, my hair.
I want it long, straight, curly, fuzzy, snaggy, shaggy, ratty, mappy, oily, greasy, fleecy, shining, steaming, gleaming, black.
Twisted, beaded, braided, powdered, flowered, and confetti, mangled, tangled, spangled,
and spaghetti.
Oh, say, can you see my eyes? If you can, then my hair's too short. Down to here, down to there, down to there, down to where it stops by itself. Don't never have to cut it, cause it stops by itself. Oh, give me a head with hair, long, shining, gleaming, streaming, flaxen, waxing. Now won't you give me down to there,
hair,
shoulder length longer,
hair,
here, baby, there, mama, everywhere, daddy, daddy, hair.
Hey, good evening, and welcome to Transpositive PDX here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland. My name is Jean Bryant. I'll be one of your hosts tonight, and here co-hosting along with me tonight is...
I'm Nicolette Schweizer, and I use and them pronouns.
And I'm Nico Serra. I use they pronouns.
All right. And I use she and her pronouns. So that's it. That, I love that song.
I do too.
I had to make sure we played it all the way through because I just love it.
I haven't actually heard it since I saw the musical when I was like 10.
Yeah, it's been years.
Yeah.
And when we thought about this topic, it just was natural. It's like, you're going to use that song, right? So, you know, the subject tonight is not so much playing with hair. It's really about the science, the medicine, the technologies around hair, growing it, not growing it, losing it, getting rid of it, moving it, all of those kind of things, and a lot of the stuff that goes along with it. So I like to say that doesn't matter whether you're an E-based life form, a T-based life form, or surfing the waves in between, there's something in this show for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So one of the first things I wanted to do now, you know, we want to talk about some fairly complex stuff, but we do have two pre-recorded interviews that will be part of this show. One of them is with an electrologist, and the other is dealing with surgery prep considerations. That's a piece from an interview with Toby Meltzer and Ellie Lay that we did several months ago that spoke to this. So with that, I'd like to lead in with just some very general, generic facts about hair. And you know, you can get all of this stuff off the internet if you take the time to look. But generally speaking, okay, all hairs have three basic growth cycles. They don't live forever. They come and go. That's stimulated or not stimulated by any number of things. So the three basic cycles are anagen, which is an actively growing stage, catagen, which is kind of a transitional stage where the hair sheds, and then there's telogen, which is the resting stage for the hair follicle, where it doesn't do anything for a little while, and then eventually it will regrow a new hair. Now, one of the truths, one of the truths about hair is you're basically born with every hair follicle you're ever going to have. Hmm. There's, I don't know, tens, hundreds, that, you know, I don't know, millions in your skin. And whether they grow in a particular way or not has to do with a lot of things in your body, not the least of which is hormones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would think that that's certainly of interest to our community, or a lot of folks in our community. But you know, there are tremendous differences between different kinds of hair. The hair on your head, for example, its growth cycle can run anywhere from about 2 to 8 years. Facial hair is about half that. Body hair is less than that. And the shortest growing hairs are like brows and lashes. So a lot depends on, you know, where the hair is.
Yeah.
Your genetics.
Yeah, and I think you were saying about how important hair is to our community, and I think one of the things that, when you said that, what came up for me is I know people who have decided not to transition based on their hair.
Hmm.
People who would otherwise transition and become trans feminine folks decided that they don't want to do it because they're bald. or because they've got a lot of thick hair and they don't know how to get rid of the thick hair on their face and all these other things. So there are options out there. So I think it's good that we're talking about this today.
Yeah.
That reminds me of something my partner said that is a concern of them, of theirs, when deciding whether or not to transition. You know, my partner is trans feminine, but the thing is they're gender fluid. And so, you know, when they're feeling feminine, they'll want to shave all their facial hair and body hair off. But then when they're feeling masculine, it can make them dysphoric to not have that hair there anymore. Right.
Yeah. And I'm a transmasculine person, and my hair migrated from my head to my face. So now I like having a big beard. But I'm balding on the top, which is tough. I know some trans masculine folks who stop taking testosterone when they start losing their hair because they just can't stand the thought of being a bald person.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've at this point sort of embraced, I was shaving my head for many years, and now I found a great barber over on 50th and Division, Tuan, who's helping me keep my hair, you know, in a style that works for me. Because it's hard to lose your hair, and it is. People
and
get self-conscious.
You know, that's not just true of folks who are, you know, definitely, you know, living a T-based life form,
right?
As I like to say it. You know, there are conditions that that AFAB folks can still have, where dihydrotestosterone can cause thinning. The male pattern baldness is different. It presents differently than it does for AFAB folks.
When, what does AFAB still mean again, just for folks who might not know?
Oh, assigned female at birth.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot going on here with this. But... you know, there are treatments like Propecia or finasteride and stuff, but those are testosterone blockers.
Oh, really?
And so for the transmasculine community, if you're on T, why would you want to be taking a testosterone blocker at the same time? It doesn't make any sense. So,
Yeah. Some folks who are getting, you know, the Rogaine and the other kinds of gels that they're putting in their heads, and they say it works. I haven't tried it, but there's a lot to it with all this stuff.
Yeah, a lot depends on how far advanced your hair loss is. If it's just starting, you can kind of stall it out. But one of the general truths here is once it's gone, it's really almost impossible to replace it. Mm. About the only way that can be done is through transplants. Mm. And even transplants have, they're not on 100% guaranteed.
Right.
Okay? They're just not. And so I've seen some evidence of transplants gone pretty, and they're expensive.
Right.
You know, the average cost for transplants, hair transplants on your head is like, I don't know, between $7,000, $12,000, can go even higher if the first grafts fail.
Right.
So it's not cheap.
No, it's not. You know? I do know some people who have, which, you know, if you want to do this, you have to shave your head forever, basically. But I know some people who get tattoos on their head.
Yes.
And that's another thing that people try. But for people of color, I'm a person of color, and we have the kinky hair. Some of us have the kinky hair, which introduces a whole other line of topics, really.
Yes. There are, you know, basically, you know, genetic differences, which includes race. How much hair, what kind of hair, skin color, hair color, all of these things affect your treatment options, and the price of those treatments and all kinds of things. So this is really complex. With that, I think what I would like to do at this point is go ahead and play a pre-recorded interview that I did several months ago with Barbara Failing. Barbara Failing is vice president of the Oregon State Electrology Association. Mm-hmm. She's been in practice here, practicing electrologist for, about 25 years or so, and she serves a lot of trans clients. She really knows a lot. So with that, let's go to the pre-recorded interview. Thank you, Soumya.
This is Jean Bryant. I'm here with Barbara Failing. She is the vice president of the Oregon State Association of Electrologists and has been in electrology practice here in the Portland area for about 25 years.
Let's talk about why electrology is really the only method of permanent hair removal, because there are other methods out there. And, you know, can we talk briefly about some of that?
Sure. Well, so you're referring to laser, and laser has limitations. With electrolysis, you can treat any kinds of all pigments, kinds of skin, and all colors of hair, where laser has limitations.
Okay, so
there's no, people will say, well, do you think I would be a candidate for electrolysis? Everybody that wants hair removal is a candidate. There's no exception. It works on every skin type and every color of hair.
Okay.
Boom.
Okay, where laser does not.
Correct. They have more limitations.
So what's the difference between, you know, how laser works on a hair?
It's light focused.
Okay.
It's light, and we use electricity inside the hair follicle.
Okay.
So the light needs to travel.
Okay, but with a laser treatment, lighter skin, dark colored hairs are affected the most.
Right.
Okay, so Barb, as if somebody has had several, you know, laser treatments, and you know, maybe some of the hairs were permanently destroyed, but not all of them, and then they come to you later for electrolysis. How does that affect your ability to treat?
Well, I can usually go ahead and continue to treat what's left. So sometimes people have laser treatments and then the hair falls out, and then they think that they feel that they've gotten some reduction and the hair comes back. I've heard people say you really need to wait 1 or 2 years after the last laser treatment to see how much reduction you've gotten. And of course, I always say that if somebody got good reduction, that I don't see them. So I see a certain kind of population.
That makes sense.
And then I have had where it maybe was a lot of treatment where it seemed to have desiccated and damaged the follicles. And it's very challenging to remove them. I remove them and the root system looks withered. It's not a healthy, typical kind of root system that I would see, and it takes longer. And I see that sometimes on the face and a lot of times like on the arms, the fine hairs that are desiccated.
Okay. So it can make it harder.
And the other thing about laser is, I don't know that much about laser, but there are different kinds of machines, and again, there are different technicians using those machines. So there's a lot of variables.
Okay.
There's a lot of variables.
A lot of variables.
And I don't know too much about, you know, who to send people for laser.
Okay, the differences between laser and electrolysis. Barb, would it be a fair statement that the answer really is, you know, in terms of a client's options, I would think that it has everything to do with what their objectives are and what kind of hair, where the hair is, those kind of things. Talk about the actual techniques that electrologists use in doing these treatments. I understand that there are several different
Modalities,
pieces of equipment, approaches to this. Tell us about some of that nuts and bolts part.
Okay, well, let's see. There are different kinds. There's two kinds of electricity, first of all. There's AC, alternating current. And alternating current, when electrons vibrate, they create friction. Friction creates heat. So AC current is more cauterizing. It cooks. Okay. DC is electrons going over a conductor, and they're electrons that unite in the follicle with ions that are in the follicle of salts and water. They form a new compound called lye. So you get a chemical reaction for destruction in the follicle. So they work two different ways, but beautifully. Beautifully.
Okay, so they effectively, I know lye, you know, kind of
burns
skin.
Right.
So basically you're cooking the hair, the stem cells of the hair follicle. Cooking.
Yes, we use that word in school.
Okay.
Yes, we do. We do use that within the profession. Uh-huh. You cook when you're learning electrolysis.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
And how is that electricity delivered?
Well, a probe. We have a probe that's placed inside the follicle and the...
So like a little needle?
I like to not call it a needle because it has a rounded tip on it. A needle has a point on it, so I call it a probe. Probe sounds nicer.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, it's got to be pretty... that's got to be really fine to be able to...
It's incredibly fine. I mean, can you imagine trying to... So the skin is like a balloon. You push your finger into a balloon, and that's pretty much how a follicle is made. So you have the same kind of skin inside of your inside a hair follicle as on the outside, and the color of the hair comes from the striated color of the skin. So that's where color comes from in the hair. So let's see, your question was, so that follicle can be microscopic. If when you start thinking how I have a lot of people that like have little sparkly hairs that they want removed, and we can get in those follicles. So it's electrolysis is pretty amazing and magical. It's really pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is.
I feel that there are two parts to a good effective electrolysis. There's an accurate insertion into that follicle. If the treatment is not in the follicle, you're treating the skin, and the skin can become more irritated. So there are two parts, the insertion and enough treatment for the treatment to impact the stem cells. So the insertion needs to be accurate and not poke through the sides of the follicle or in the skin. The second part is enough treatment for the hair to, when it's removed, it slides and release. And the word is slide and release.
Okay, so when you say treatment, you mean enough heat.
Enough treatment, enough chemicals, enough current.
It's got to be cooked enough.
Enough current for the hair to slide and release. If it's pulled, if it pulls, then if there are stem cells on that hair, the stem cells tear and the stem cells stay in the follicle to go on to make another hair. And you've missed that opportunity if it was in the fast-growing stage for reduction. So your hairs can be removed and you're not getting any reduction. You're only getting reduction when all the stem cells are on the follicle, and the follicle, the hair is removed with all the stem cells and the follicle is empty. Then the follicle can no longer make another hair, and that's your reduction.
Okay. So in order to truly, to actually be effective, it has to be pretty darn close to a perfect, proper combination of all those factors with the insertion and the
enough treatment for
treatment
the hair
delivery,
yes,
and all of that.
Yes.
Okay, so most human beings, in my experience, I like to use an analogy to being back in school, grade on the curve or whatever. And if you're hitting, low to mid 90s in most classes, you're going to get probably an A- or something. You're performing at a pretty high level. So as a practitioner, certainly not everyone is perfect.
I try to.
I understand. So again, in terms of the efficacy of treatment, even an excellent performing technician is not going to be perfect all the time. If they're running at a high, in the 90 percentile, that's good human being performance. So there's another, say, 6, 8, 10% of treatment that may not be fully effective, and you add that to the different cycles and all of that.
Mm-hmm,
So even excellent performance doesn't immediately guarantee that you've got the hair.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So another reason why it takes so long and so many treatments. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Clearing is a definition to me, and I think other people have used it differently. Clearing is when you finally get to the point where you clear all the hair in the area that you want at that time. And then that doesn't mean you have hair gone. It means that you've been able to treat all the hairs that you wanted to do at that time.
That you can see.
That you can see at this moment.
At this moment.
And then
yes.
You start waiting for the waves of hair to come in, and they will be further and further and further apart. So you have choices of how often and how frequency. So I think when you're very close, you should be able to go a long time between treatments.
So in terms of timelines, now, you know, earlier in this conversation, you were describing that some of the differences between the hair and the different parts of the body, you know, hair on your head versus eyebrows and eyelashes versus, say, facial hair versus underarm versus, so.
And there are different, there are finer hairs and heavier hairs.
Yeah.
Too, so those have very different timings. I would say just plan on more time than you need for electrolysis.
Okay, that's, I guess that's what I'm fishing for here. You've treated a lot of people. What kind of timelines have you generally seen being considered, you know, effective?
I don't think I can give you an answer right now.
Okay. Well, I know there's a lot of variables in that. There has to be. I mean, not the least of which being how long someone can actually stay in the chair and tolerate the treatment.
Okay.
And we talked about the length of appointments and then the frequency of appointments and then the cycles and all these variables that are, and there's going to be variables between individuals.
I think a lot with electrolysis and when you're wondering how close you are, and I think kind of as you go along, you'll see that. And when you see that the hair is reduced and less in the areas that you want, you'll begin to say, I think we're here. But I can't really give you a timeline on that. And I think, and then
because it takes, you know, I know from experience, it takes months and months. This is measured in months.
Of course. Absolutely.
And months and months and months, not weeks.
No. Oh, no. You're right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. You know, different people have different amounts of hair. So I've had, you know, a spectrum. You know, you just keep working.
Start early and keep going until you get done.
Yes. And when you think you're getting close, you'll kind of know the difference.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I like to say about, you know, on this topic is it's not the electrologist or the surgeon that's going to have to live with the end results.
Aha.
Because, you know, you as an electrologist, you specialize in hair removal. You can't just take a look at somebody's skin and say, that's done. Right. Nobody can.
You have to know the history of
the treatment. Yeah, the surgeons don't know either.
Right.
They may take a look at you when you're standing there and go, it looks good to me. But later on, so the only person that I think, as a patient, you know, the only person that a patient can really rely on is the patient.
Themselves.
You're going to be the only one who really knows. And you're the one that's going to have to live with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you can't, you cheat anybody, you're only going to cheat yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Seems logical to me that if you're cooking parts of the skin, there are concerns
about
that.
Well, that opens a whole nother question about skin. No two people are the same. And if someone that calls me on the phone as a new client and asks me how their skin would be, I don't know. I can only ask them questions to predict what their skin would, what kind of response it would have. So, you know, I'm putting heat into the skin. You might pink up more than another person. So that's all into consideration in the treatment and how concentrated you would work. And how, because part of electrolysis is the art of taking care of the skin.
Okay. So pinking up, that would be kind of an immediate short-term reaction evidence.
Yes, and some people that pink up really fast rebound. So it's like an elastic. It springs back really quickly. As we mature, our skin thins and we lose that elasticity. So there's all kinds of differences with ages also.
Oh, okay. Well, I know from life experience that if I burn myself, it usually leaves a much longer scarring, that kind of stuff. Can that kind of stuff happen?
I think a lot of people go online to find out about electrolysis and they read about scarring. You're not supposed to scar. You're supposed to protect the skin more. But that may have happened decades ago with machines that didn't have as much control. I have different things where I can adjust the probe that I use and a product that I use after the skin. And also, I am finding that icing after the treatment for when people really pink up a lot is really, 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 really helpful. And you also want to make sure that you keep everything clean and not contaminated. It really, really helps after treatment when they get home.
Yeah, okay, so that's kind of after treatment.
Right, right.
You know, one of the truths about hair removal is it's painful.
Yes, it is. People ask me, is it painful? Well, I said, well, we're putting electricity into the skin, so yes.
It hurts. So, you know, what are some of the ways, the most effective ways that you've seen for your clients, and what kind of things do you kind of normally recommend
to
your clients?
Well, first of all, with
pain management.
First of all, I think with pain, I'm learning that sleep is really important.
Really? I don't understand why that would be important.
People that have lack of sleep are more uncomfortable, more sensitive, and I see that with my clients profoundly.
Oh, wow.
So sleep will vary your discomfort. But when we're talking about pain management, we're talking about two parts, the internal and the external. And so internal, you can take over-the-counter Tylenol, or you can talk to your doctors about other options of pain control for internal. The external, we have a plethora of over-the-counter kinds of things nowadays. The 5% lidocaine that we used to use now is over-the-counter and is half the cost that we used to be charged. So that's wonderful. Some of it's very accessible. With the 5% and the 4% lidocaines, I'd be very careful and look. Some of them are really runny, and they flake up and dry up, and I feel like the moisture in the lidocaine is the vehicle that enters the skin. The other thing is, okay, and then we have prescription level canes, and they can be compounded, and so they are prescriptions of I call it a triple cane. So it's a benzocaine, a lidocaine, and a tryptocaine, and all of those kind of enter the body at a different rate and longevity. That is considered a prescription. We have compounders in Portland area that do that. A lot of my clients it's kind of like a mail order to Canada, and I think that that's probably a better price, but there's a shipping cost to that. One of the things years ago with the compounding, the triple cane, is that you had to be careful with the air exposure. And a lot of those compounding have a screw top, and as you use it, there's more and more air in it. Whereas the tubes that come from Canada, the triple cane, they are in a tube, so they are never exposed to a lot of air.
Good tips.
Okay. And the other thing is, when using the topicals, the canes, I think there are two things that people do not do. They don't put enough on, and you need to really butter it on and not be stingy. You need a good amount. And then I really encourage my clients to put a plastic covering over it, and you can use, my favorite is a sandwich bag. I like the gauge of a sandwich bag, and you can cut that up and put that over the skin, and that keeps the product, the lidocaine, the canes from drying out. And I feel like it's the moisture that enters the skin that is the vehicle that allows the canes to do its work.
Okay. How long does it usually take?
The longer the better. The longer the better.
Okay.
The longer the better.
So walking in from the parking lot with a plastic bag stuck to your face.
I know. You can take it off and then put it back on and put some more cream on when you arrive.
Do you have any tips for folks out there who have yet to start electrolysis? Any tips for them as to how to find and connect with an electrologist?
Well, chances are you've already started researching what electrolysis is and about it, and I would suggest that people start finding looking at websites on electrologists that are in their area. Kind of look at the websites, call all the people that they are interested in, and talk to all of them, and think in terms of that you are interviewing the electrologist. And I would really pay attention to the questions the electrologist asks you, and you're going to get a certain feel from each of these electrologists, and that you might choose a couple of the electrologists that you've talked to. And, you know, what you can do is call and say, I'm just new to the area, so forth. I'm just wondering what your hours are and so forth. And just ask several questions. And then they'll ask you questions and see how you feel. See how comfortable you are feeling with that individual. You can choose one or two or three of those individuals, and you can make short little appointments with them and see how comfortable you feel in the office. Chances are your electrolysis experience is going to be a long one, and you might as well have the best that works for you. Have the electrologist that you feel most comfortable mm-hmm. with, and every one of us are different, so no two experiences are going to be the same. But it's going to give you a really an insight to how different offices feel and how the practices run.
Yeah. And especially for trans folks, that can be a very uncomfortable initial mm-hmm. Interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And probably get pretty good takeaways from those initial interactions.
Well, also when you call, you should tell them that you're transitioning, because that electrologist might have different questions to ask you. And if you're wanting reassignment prep electrolysis, there's some electrologists that prefer not to do that work they prefer not to work below the waist. And that's an opportunity for that electrologist to share that with you. They may be very happy to do above the waist and refer you to another electrologist. Okay?
Yeah. Yeah, those are all good points. Well, Barbara, I want to thank you for your time today, this evening. And I thank you so much for your service to our community.
Thank you.
The trans community, you have just been, you're just wonderful. You're so great with us.
Well, thank you for giving me an opportunity to share electrolysis. It's a wonderful, it's a magical science. It's really magical, and it's intriguing, and it's a piece of science, and I never get tired doing it, so yeah, you're exciting.
You're so passionate about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You love what you do.
Thank you. Thank
and
you.
We love you for it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And good night.
Okay. So, you know, that was a lot about electrolysis. We still have other things to cover in the show, but very quickly, I wanted to comment that a couple things. Kind of the going rates around Portland for electrology seem to range anywhere from about $85 an hour up to about $120 an hour. And if we're talking about the surgical prep stuff below the waist, that tends to usually run, that high. About $120 an hour, if you can find someone that does it. Not all of them do. Then the other thing that's kind of new is that insurance coverages are beginning to get a little better around this question, especially for the surgery prep stuff, because it's linked to the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Even a couple of insurances out there are beginning to cover like facial electrolysis for trans women as well, but that's very few and far between. Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that insurance companies are starting to cover it. Of course, you know, I've got a lot of complex medical needs, and I know that it's really hard to get things covered sometimes, and sometimes you have to be the squeaky wheel, or, you know, there are different strategies to getting things covered.
Yes.
But there's always there seems to always be a fight there for anything that's kind of outside of the box, which is frustrating and is the current reality we're stuck in.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll keep working. We'll all keep pushing together.
Yep. And then the other piece that we touched kind of lightly there with Barbara on was laser. And laser, you know, laser packages tend to, because I've done some of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's still a lot of money out of pocket.
Yeah.
You know, $500 or more, usually for, you know, like a 4-treatment package, that mm-hmm. kind of thing over time here around Portland. So it's still a lot of out-of-pocket cost. Now I would like to play a pre-recorded piece that was with the GRS surgeons, Meltzer and Lay, that we did here back early winter. I think it was November or December. Mm-hmm. And they're speaking specifically to surgery prep.
Dr. Meltzer made a comment here just a few minutes ago, which I thought was a good segue to this question. And it's hair removal. It's electrolysis. And electrolysis is critical in, regardless of whether it's transmasculine or transfeminine, you know, surgeries, and or at least hair removal is. And so my question for you, I see out there in social media, et cetera, that there are surgeons out there who say that they will do what I understand is like follicle scraping or some sort of surgical process that will eliminate the hair follicles. Is that something that's real? I mean, does that work? Is that something that just causes a lot of confusion out there? Can you speak to sure. your rationale for what you ask from your patients?
Okay. Well, it's it, you know, back in the mid-90s, I realized I could probably get more depth if I used a scrotal graft on most of my patients. But before I would ever do that, I had that very first patient have electrolysis of scrotum, which back in the early 90s was a very difficult thing to get a electrologist to do. But I had done a burn fellowship in my training, and I knew that I could transplant follicles. I mean, if you can move hair, if you take hair-bearing skin, you'll transfer hair-bearing skin, no matter how thin you make the skin, and no matter how you what you do to it, there are dormant follicles that you may not see that can grow hair. So I would insist if I were going to take a scrotal graft that I would have my patients would have electrolysis. Now, at the same time I was saying that, and still even to date, there are people that claim that you can, quote, scrape the skin, which means thin it. They're not doing anything special, but they're thinning the skin, thinning the dermis portion of the skin, so where the hair follicles actually originate in the subcutaneous fat, and claim that that will eliminate all the follicles. And they take an electrocautery and buzz all the follicles they see. The problem is again, what happens to the dormant follicles, the ones that you don't see? And we know that hair grows in cycles. So if you're missing them, then you can transplant hair. So I've seen over in my career, I've seen a fairly significant number of patients who are upset that they were told that they did not need to have electrolysis because it could be taken care of at the day of surgery. And I just don't think that's true. I don't think you can. And I wouldn't want to take that chance. I don't think that hair causes a true physical problem because I think in most cases it's fairly sparse when it does grow. But it can be, you know, it can be a source of concern. It can cause some functional problems. And it can be treated afterwards, but I would rather avoid that by treating them with having them had electrolysis. Now, that being said, as we know, there are two types of electrolysis, either laser electrolysis or standard electrolysis, which is thermal electrolysis. And the problem with laser electrolysis is that you can see regrowth up to 2 years after treatment. And most people are going to come to us in less than 2 years of treatment. So you can still get hair growth, and that could recur intravaginally. Whereas electrolysis done correctly over about a year's time period, meaning three treatments done about 10 to 12 weeks apart, at least three times, over a year, you should take care of almost all of the hair follicles doing it that way. And so that's our present recommendation, is standard electrolysis done over a year time, sometimes greater. You have to go with the experience of the electrologist. And it really does better to have a complete clearing and then just come back 12 weeks later and do it again than to do it weekly, because weekly takes a huge amount of time.
Phalloplasty, you know, and
equally important.
Equally important because of using some of that tissue for the urethral extension. I would assume you said yes, that in the case of a neo vagina, arguably some things can be addressed afterwards, though not easily. In the case of a phalloplasty, you know, the tissue that's being lifted to be used for that urethral extension.
Yeah, absolutely. You do not want hair in the urethra. Hair does very poorly in the urethra. It forms concretions, form around it. Yeah. It can obstruct flow.
So if I may interject, those patients are classically going to be on testosterone HRT therapy, which would then be stimulating, you know, hair growth in some of those areas. So, but the forearm technique or the thigh technique, is that largely because of the lack of hair there, or?
No, I think on testosterone, hair grows everywhere, and they tend to lose it on the top of their head, and they grow it everywhere else. So you have to, some patients are relatively hairless in that area, but if you look at them, even though they may not have dark hair, they have thin villous hair there. That's not the reason why we choose the area, but we do require, and Dr. Lake marks out on those patients where we want them to treat, which is the urethral portion. But the penile portion they can treat after surgery. But we want the urethra cleared exactly the same way. It's got to be done at least a year, standard electrolysis, because hair in the urethra does mixing perform very poorly. And it's very, very difficult to treat. I've treated it in the past with a diode laser, which has been relatively effective, but it's very expensive to do, and I'd rather avoid that. So, I mean, you have to run the laser through a cystoscope to be able to do it, and it's not very fun to do.
Yeah, so this whole general topic, shortcutting doesn't do anybody any favors, especially the patient.
No, and you have to get your patients to be honest with you.
Yes.
A lot of times we've been fooled because they'll say, oh, I don't have any hair on my arm, I'm great, I had electrolysis. And then we scope them after the procedure, and we're seeing hair grow in there.
Yeah. So you can't. So what I'm hearing is no surgeon can just like take a look at a piece of skin and go, oh yeah, okay, look, you know.
No, yeah. You rely on your patients
to
be honest with you.
They're
so anxious to get these things done. Sometimes they'll override that, and it's critical because just like with the scrotum, we don't want hair there.
So thank you.
It's more important for the guys to have the electrolysis done well and thoroughly, because we don't scrape that portion. There's no thinning of that segment that's going to become a urethra. That tissue has to be taken full thickness in order to preserve all the blood supply innervation to it. Unlike for the trans women, where yes, you get electrolysis, but in addition to that, we end up doing the scraping and the thinning of the tissue for grafting. And so that's a big difference between what's required for the guys over the girls.
In most cases, I've seen very dense hair actually in the vagina, but nothing like what you see with somebody who's inadequately treated an arm for a radial forearm without adequate electrolysis, because in those cases, I've treated them before where literally they had very little decent urine flow because there was so much obstruction because of all the hair and concretions.
Okay, that was from an interview that we did earlier this winter. So far, we've talked an awful lot about, you know, kind of hair in general and a lot of removal stuff. Let's talk now, as we get towards the end of the show, about a couple other things, like growing it, moving it, and, in this piece, Toby Meltzer's talking about, you know, you grab hair-bearing skin, you transplant it, you're transplanting hair transplants, to replace hair on your head is typically where that is used, and so, you know, I've looked into that. I've never done any of that myself. But again, it's super expensive. Mm-hmm. It's like super, super expensive. You're talking, you know, $10,000-$12,000. And there's no guarantees. There's no guarantees that it's going to take, because even though, you're grafting hair-bearing skin, if the blood supply is not there to support that, it's like a garden, you know. If the water isn't there, the garden won't grow. And mm-hmm. one of the best services I had, my own life experience, is I had a consultation with Douglas Osterhout down in San Francisco years ago. He kind of considered the father of facial feminization, and he was also doing a lot of hair transplant stuff. And he took a look at parts of like my hairline, you know, my forehead and stuff. And he said, "You know what? I've seen a lot of this. Take it from me. You're too far gone. Mm-hmm. You could transplant hair and transplant hair and transplant hair, and some of it would take, some of it's not going to take. Save your money." That's basically what he told me.
Wow, yeah.
And I thought that was a real good service that he gave me in terms of information. So, you know, even transplanting hair isn't like the perfect solution for some of us.
Right.
So, yeah, Nico, let's talk about growing some hair there, buddy.
Sure. Yeah. So, one of the things about hormones is people say they give, but they don't take. So for transmasculine folks, beyond not in testosterone, a lot of us get way hairier, all over hairier, and growing facial hair. And I think I have met guys who that was their big goal about transitioning, is that they needed to grow facial hair to feel like they've made it. I have a full beard right now. I tend to grow it out in the, you know, cooler time of year, and then I might go down to a goatee in the summer or something. But I love having a beard. I really do. I just love it. You know, the other, where hair grows everywhere, I'm not, you know, then you've got back hair and, you know, all this others, the hair on your forearms gets, you know, thicker and longer and things like that. So, you know, it's a little weird at first, you know, when you start seeing all this hair, and for a lot of people, it's like, oh, I finally made it. I have, you know, the peach fuzz, and it takes a while. I started before I had started testosterone, I already had some facial hair. So when we're talking about electrolysis and laser and stuff, back when I was pretending to be a woman, I did those things. And then after I realized I was going to transition, I stopped shaving, and then I started hormones not long after that, and things grew out. But it takes some time. It really does take some time.
Yeah. So just for you, like, how long did it take for you to get to? Because you have one hella beautiful beard there, my friend.
Thanks. For me, it was relatively quick. I would say within like the first year, I had at least peach fuzz all over and more of a thicker goatee and a mustache and things like that. But I know some people, it's like their hair will grow on their neck first, and then it kind of creeps up their face. So it's just like each person, it grows differently. And, you know, it can be a little awkward while it's growing in. I remember my beard kind of grew all the way up, but then there was like a line on both sides before it connected to the head of my hair. Yeah. And so people were like, why do you trim your hair like that? You know, and I was like, I don't. It just doesn't grow there yet. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, I really dig it. I like having the hair. I will say that for like sweeping and cleaning the house now, it's like it looks like, you know, the hair pile at the end. My partner's also a very hairy person. It looks like a chihuahua almost in the in the little dustbin. But I love it. I love being a hairy person. It's fun for me.
Oh, you know. And it's taken me years and years and years and years to try to get rid of them. Anyway.
Yeah.
Golly. You know, there's a lot more that could be talked about on this subject. Tons and tons. There are hormonal things and all kinds of stuff that, in terms of health, you know, that come into play with whether hair's growing or not growing, whether it's falling out. There's so much, but a lot of it is, you know, hormonal shifts are some of the key triggers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other piece is, I know in terms of losing hair, mm-hmm. is stress.
Yeah.
Now, you know, who would ever think that people in the trans community are stressed? Right.
Like, yeah. Oh, never.
Never.
Yeah, well, and the electrolysis was saying that too about dealing with pain. I know I'm a person with I've got a lot of disabilities and a lot of chronic pain and things like that. And how much sleep I get absolutely impacts my pain levels. So of course it makes sense that when people are going in to get treatment, if you've only gotten a few, you know, you only got a few hours of sleep, it's going to hurt more.
Yeah.
And in general, I would say, at least for myself, that when I don't get as much sleep, I'm in a lot more pain.
Yeah.
You know, so of course, yeah, like you're saying, our communities, we have tons of stress. We have, you know, coming from all directions and coming from within ourselves about whether we're this or that enough. So being able to figure out, you know, skills and tools to get ourselves kind of back into the center of our center so that we can get good rest and, you know, be able to take care of ourselves like we need to.
Yeah. Well, we're going to wrap up that this whole piece on hair here, and we've got some announcements. First of all, I want to point out that KBOO's spring membership drive will be starting next week, so it'll be running through the middle of the month. And you know, KBOO gives us a forum for some marginalized voices and support.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other one is the OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences University Trans Health Program, is seeking to start a community advisory board. Hmm. I think it's a great opportunity for us to give direct input to some of that care. And the applications are available on the OHSU Transgender Health page. Online, about midway down the page, you'll see it described there. I think Nicole had some stuff.
Yeah, a couple other events going on this month. On April 28th at 7 p.m., the Q Center is going to be hosting a workshop about situational awareness, which I think is super important right now when we're dealing with all these attacks on trans people lately. So again, that's April 28th at 7 p.m. at the Q Center. And then April 18th is National Transgender HIV Testing Day. So through that week, we're going to be having a few places offering free STD testing. On the 18th, the Q Center will be hosting testing from 2 to 7 p.m. Then April 19th, the PCC Cascade Campus will be having testing in the Student Union Building, Room 210, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And that same day, the PCC Southeast Campus will be doing theirs in Mount Tabor Hall, Room 149, from 2 to 6 p.m. Then also on April 21st, Prism Health will be holding testing from 2 to 7 p.m.
All right. Thanks for listening tonight.
Thank you. Have a good night, everyone. Thank you.
Hope you're all well.
Give me a head with hair. Long, beautiful hair. Shining, gleaming, streaming, flaxing, waxing. Give me down to there. Shoulder length longer. Here, baby, there, mama. Everywhere, daddy, daddy. Grow it, show it. Caught in the trees, a home for the fleas in my hair. A home for the fleas, a hive for the buzzing bees, a nest for birds. There ain't no words for the beauty, the splendor, the wonder of my hair. Grow it, show it.
Powdered, flowered, and confetti, mangled, tangled, spangled,
and spaghetti.
Oh, say,
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Zenith's Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Friday, April 5th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the City of Portland Water Pollution Control Laboratory in Portland. Second in a series of community forums on Zenith Energy's Tar Sands Oil Export Expansion, this event will supply project background, climate justice impacts, health and safety risks, and ideas for public action around Zenith's oil terminal. A variety of perspectives will be presented. Again, that's the Zenith's Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Friday, April 5th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the City of Portland Water Pollution Control Laboratory, 6543 North Burlington Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio starts our spring membership drive starting April 8th, and before that, we'd love to hear from you directly about why you support KBOO. My name is Mo, a KBOO volunteer, and I support KBOO because I grew up with KBOO. It's part of my life, and I feel having a community outlet like KBOO is so important because it creates a more vibrant community and a place where different ideas are not only heard but honored. Why do you support KBOO? Call us and let us know at 503-231-8032, extension 302, to leave a voicemail or tag us with your support on your social media posts. And thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO.